Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series. That's toughmantri.com, by VeloFix.com, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar, blood, sweat, and data. By CaliforniaTriathlon.org, they've got five great 2019 race options, including Viking Dash Trail Run LA on April 7th. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation, this last year we sent out 2,806 grants, totaling $4.3 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. You can help out at ChallengedAthletes.org and check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. Our next guest, she lost her leg above the knee when she was 9 years old, 2016 Paralympian. Her name is Lacey Henderson. Lacey, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. So when you're a little girl, and now is this back in Colorado?
Yes, sir.
And you were diagnosed. How old were you when you were diagnosed with cancer?
I was nine. It was a really quick kind of experience. I was diagnosed when I was nine, and right before I turned 10 was when my amputation occurred.
Wow. And what sports were you into beforehand, before your injury?
Ironically, I actually was doing a lot of track and field before. My dad is he's a former track athlete. He's a two-time national decathlon champ and went to the Olympic trials for pole vault. So he had my brother and I at like 5 and 6 doing triple jump drills down the sidewalk.
It is so funny. That's cool. So he was a big-time decathlete. I mean, I don't think there's anything more brutal than the decathlon.
Yeah, you have to be like a little bit of a masochist and a little insane. And he fit that criteria, no problem.
It's funny because when you watch that, here you're throwing the shot in the discus. At the same time, you're running the sprints and you're running the 1500 last, which is probably, for most of these guys, the 1500 is the thing they hate the most. And then they have to do that last after their body is totally beat to crap.
Yep, absolutely.
God. So after you lost your leg, how did that, because we're talking a number of years ago, obviously things have changed today. How did that affect you in terms of sport?
I'm coming up on my 20-year anniversary, so it was a little bit of a while ago. But honestly, my parents, like, they come from an older generation, so they kind of, they're like definitely like bootstrap kind of people. So when I was, after my amputation, they basically were like, all right, well, Lacey, you had two legs, now you have one. And whatever sport you want to pursue, you will just have to figure out a way to do it. We didn't know anything about Paralympics. We didn't know anything about disabled sports. So I ended up falling in love with the world of competitive cheerleading.
Yep.
Eventually I ended up being a national varsity competitive cheerleader in high school, and I got a Division I athletic scholarship to the University of Denver for cheer before I even had heard of disabled sports.
And you found track and field in 2012?
Yeah, it was coming into, it was 2011, 2012, so I was just about to graduate college, which was perfect timing because we were healthy into a recession, so no one was getting jobs, and
right. It's
kind of like track found me, and it projected into like a really amazing career.
What's always fascinating to me is there's so much awareness now for people who are, you know, who are missing legs or people in wheelchairs. But for a lot of times, I mean, did you know other people who were amputees growing up at all?
No, definitely not. That was like the one main thing that was the scariest part of being sick was they kept bringing up, you know, the idea of amputation. And we wanted to avoid that at all costs. My tumor didn't respond at all to the treatment, so that became our only option. And yeah, I was never exposed to the world of disability. I didn't know anyone who was an amputee. I never met anyone in a wheelchair. And so it seemed really scary and really far away up until I had to join the community myself. And even growing up, you know, I was the only amputee in my community. And I know a lot of kids feel that way even today. Like, you know, even when they're close-knit communities, they are the only one that's affected by limb loss or some sort of mobility impairment. And we're at a really cool time in the world, though, to have the technology of Facebook and to connect us to other people who are going through similar things, and things like the Challenge Athletes Foundation, where you can see the possibility of like where you can push yourself, maybe where you can end up as far as a career goes, which is incredible.
What's fascinating, I remember, you know, we started putting on Standing Up Triathlon Challenge 25 years ago. And it was a few years in, and you know, what you don't realize, because we're so immersed in it on a day-to-day basis. And I remember a mom coming up to me at Standing Up Triathlon Challenge. She goes, "You know, you guys don't realize that for 364 days a year, my son feels like a freak because he doesn't know anybody like himself. He's never seen anybody like himself until he came here and sees 150 people, legs laying all over the place, wheelchairs everywhere." Right? Yep. It was sort of that, wait a second, I'm not alone. There is a community here that I can be a part of. When did you become part of that community?
I started volunteering at the Amputee Coalition's youth camp, going into my senior year of college. I had known my process growing up, always made sure that I got whatever I needed to do, what I had set out to do. So I knew that my experience was most likely unique, especially coming as a Division I athlete and an above-the-knee amputee. So I was like, okay, I'm going to volunteer at camp, and I'm going to, you know, be an inspiration for these kids. And the ironic thing is I went to camp, and I feel like I had way more fun than any of my kids, and I learned so much, and I learned about running prosthetics. I learned about, you know, just the amputee community, the disability community, and my family and my community has always been so supportive, but there really is something really special about the solidarity of being around people who are similar like you and have those similar struggles, and it's amazing what you learn. I still learn from people every day, and I've been an amputee now for 20 years.
Well, and that's the one thing we hear from some of the prosthetists who come to the events. They learn from each other. It's like, yeah. Oh, look at what they built for Scout there. That's pretty amazing. How can we do something like that? So did your dad challenge you to try pole vaulting?
Yeah. Honestly, my family, we have a sickness. Like, we are overly competitive. We're loud. We're a little crazy. And so going in, this is like it was so funny because my senior year of college was a really serendipitous time, I would say, as far as being integrated into the amputee community, being integrated into disabled sport, and finding track and field. So when I was a senior in college, I taught my dad, who is 73 this year, I taught him how to play beer pong. And as a collegiate student athlete would.
Of course.
And he was smoking me. Like, he was killing me at beer pong. So the only way to really just keep my dignity is, we started talking mad trash to each other. Somehow the conversation turned into who is a better athlete. And again, at 21, you have all the confidence in the world. So I'm going in, I'm like, listen, I'm a Division I athlete, I'm an amputee, I'm obviously the superior athlete. And my dad was like, listen, Lacey, he's like, you couldn't learn how to pole vault 2 feet.
Oh, that's a challenge.
Such a disrespectful number. So of course I took that challenge on. And again, I'm so lucky because only my family would just readily have a pole vault pit and pole vault poles just ready.
just hanging around the house.
The next day, yeah. So his beer pong partner actually was his former athlete who's a coach now, a high school coach in Colorado. And his partner was like, listen, Lace, you want to come to the track tomorrow? We'll set you up and we'll get you jumping. So sure enough, I rolled through the next day and I jumped 6 feet on my
first time.
On my first try.
Oh, yeah. Dad owed big time.
Oh, yeah.
So when did you start thinking, you know what, Paralympics, this might be a real deal?
I started competing in indoor meets for pole vault and a couple outdoor meets just because I really enjoy pole vault. And the more I looked up amputee pole vaulter, I was getting rerouted to Paralympics. And even at that time, through my ignorance and just under education of Paralympics, I had thought it was something similar to Special Olympics. And
right.
I'm like, listen, I don't need to be a part of a special group. So I just kept jumping, and as I was getting coached, my dad was actually coaching me. He had me start racing a little bit just because the faster you get to the box, the higher you can jump, you just get better overall marks. So I did a couple indoor races. I did one outdoor 100 meter race, and that my first ever 100, I qualified for London. So that's when I was like, oh my gosh, like maybe I'm good at this.
Maybe. Yeah.
And so my second race was the 2011 Paralympic National Championships in Miramar, and I went in feeling like I was the hottest athlete there, and I quickly got my butt kicked in that race, and I realized that disabled sport was not what I had thought it was.
No, it's hard. It's deep. The fields are deep.
The fields are getting really deep, and there's incredible talent out there, and I thought, I was like, I'm a Division I athlete. I'm going to show these like cute disabled people. And sure enough, like I saw nothing but booty at the end of that race. and it was good because like I have an insatiable competitiveness too. So yes. I'm like, listen, this is not how this ends. So you know, we started taking track seriously. I avoided long jump for a while. I didn't love the idea of getting dirty.
Right.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Coming from a cheer background, I'm like, yucky. But I started jumping in 2013, and that's really where things took off. I broke a 17-year-long American record. I made my first Worlds team, and it felt like a good compromise between pole vault and racing.
Yeah, and then 2015 U.S. Paralympics track and field national championships. You got third in 100 and fourth in the long jump.
Yes.
Yeah, and so
that was Worlds.
And
yeah.
When you qualified to go to Rio, what mm-hmm. where was that? Was that in Charlotte?
That was in Charlotte, North Carolina.
I was there. That was really fun because you had the track going on, you had cycling going on, and you had swimming going on all in the same area.
Yeah, they had all three of those.
I should always do that. It was so fun. You could just go from one to the other and watch. It was like being at the Olympics.
Yeah, well, it's a big event. You know, I think we should make these things bigger and more inclusive
totally.
For all the sports.
I agree. So that Paralympic experience down in Rio, what was that like for you?
It was incredible. I mean, it's something. 2012, I had attempted for London, for the London Games. I didn't make the team, which honestly I think is good because I didn't understand the amount of work and the sacrifice that you need to make in order to make a team. So 2016, you know, it was my time, and I was just so overwhelmed with gratitude. And I mean, it was hilarious too because I lived in South America. I lived in Argentina, so I knew going down to Brazil it was going to be a crazy circus, and sure enough,
yes.
like... You know, like toilets were exploding. People were like,
I was there. I know.
Yeah,
if you, wherever you stayed, you were hours away from wherever you needed to be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and like, you know, South America, like, I love the South American culture too because they're like, oh, no problem. You're like, no, this will be a problem. So,
yeah, yeah. Oh, we'll pick you up at 6 and they show up at 9. And you're like,
yeah.
And it's like, no big deal. Oh, wait, you ready? You're 3 hours late. In the U.S., that doesn't play. But when you're in South America, it's sort of like, whenever. We'll get
you know,
there eventually.
Like, yeah, you get there. But, I mean, it was fun because, you know, it's like it's all of your hard work paid off, made real, made into the physical world. So it was great to be able to be in the environment where it's not only you are paying your dues, you're getting your debts paid, but also you're surrounded by people that know the work and the sacrifice that it took as well. And so the games are cool because it's a competition, but at the same time, there's this really cool camaraderie, I feel, with a lot of the other countries just because, you know, we all work so hard to get to the big show, and it's something to celebrate.
So in Rio, did you run the 100 and do the long jump?
Yeah, I jumped and then I raced as well at the end of the week.
And that's tough to balance that because you got heats in the run and then you got the long jump. It's a lot of stuff for 2020. Is the focus primarily long jump?
Yeah, it's going to be jumps from here on out. I decided in 2017 after just, as you and I had talked briefly before, just some life circumstances had happened. And I'm like, you know, if I learned one thing from Rio, it's that being intensely present was really the most important thing for me. And so that is a hard thing to manage. The way that a lot of those meets are set up, too, is that your jumps are in the beginning of the week for a major competition and the races later on in the week. And it takes a mental and an emotional endurance on top of just physically being on top of the game. And so I love jumps. I admire people who are good racers. And I was fast. I'm pretty quick. But there's like a mentality that's really like an intense mentality that I'm like a funly, friendly, jokey kind of gal, you know? And I'm just like, it's fun, but like, I love jumps. I love jumps. We help each other out on the runway. You know, you cheer for each other. You want to do well. And ultimately, top three are, you know, the ones who get landed on the podium. But at the same time, like, you're happy for other people, which I think is healthy and important. And that just fits best with me.
Well, what's great about that is it's not like you're lined up next to somebody and you need to beat them. It's you against, really, you're jumping against the pit. It's how far
exactly.
can you push yourself in the pit? And
exactly.
if you can help another person achieve their goal, what's wrong with that? It seems like that's the healthy way of sport.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's really the true spirit. I think it's, like, in my experience, that's the true spirit of sport is, you know, it's a team effort. And, again, maybe that's because I came from team sports that track and field felt so awkward for a while because I'm so used to working collaboratively with other people to achieve a goal. So it's just like, it just fits. And I love long jump. It feels like poetry to me.
So talk a little bit about the life events that you had in 2017, because all of a sudden you're dealing with some pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I think you hear everybody in para has the most incredible stories of like how we acquire our disabilities.
Sure.
But we forget that it's like, you know, life will still happen regardless of those major events as well. So 2017 started off, I was in a hit and run car accident. And the person that hit me actually ended up dying later from some sort of substance overdose. And it was a nightmare combination of injuries, of lawyers, of insurance settlements, all this stuff. So my time managing skills had to get much better in regards to prioritizing training, also recovering rehab on top of just training. But now these new injuries and, you know, trying not to lose my sanity dealing with insurance attorneys and all that kind of stuff as well.
So the guy turns left right into your car and then he's there. The police are on the way. He probably realizes, you know what, I'm a little under the influence here. And he leaves the car and runs off like he's going to get away, right? Like
it was a literal hit and run. Like he got out of the car and ran. Like
he ran. I love that. That is wild. So while you're watching this guy run away, you're thinking, "What the hell?"
I was like trying. I was in shock.
Mostly. Yeah.
I didn't realize that he had left until the fire department came first because my car was just destroyed and it was leaking fluid. And I was like, oh, he must still be in his car getting his ID. That's where he told me he was going to go. And you could tell these guys looked at me so, they were like, oh, honey, no. And I was like, he's going to come back. And they just looked at me. And I remember Keely like looking at one firefighter and I was like, listen, I was like, I'm going to ask you this twice. One, I just want you to say what I want you to say. And two, tell me the truth. He's like, okay. I'm like, is he going to come back? The first answer, he's like, yeah, for sure. He's going to come back. I look at him. I'm like, he's not coming back, is he? This guy's like, ain't no way that guy's going to come back. And he never came back.
But they must have tracked him down.
Eventually, I went to one criminal court case, with him. And then he ended up, unfortunately, he ended up passing away during the middle of all of this.
Oh, my God. So now I'm sure his insurance company. I'm sure if he had an insurance company, the last thing they want to do is take care of anything because this guy's gone. He's not paying he's not paying any fees anytime soon.
No. Yeah, definitely not. We got creative and, talk about it. Being in an adaptive world, we had to adapt to a lot of other circumstances, but that chapter of my life closed, but it was a living nightmare for a little bit.
And what were the injuries from that?
I had a high ankle sprain, which is, as an amputee,
it's a big deal.
Kind of scary.
I mean, basically, you're in a wheelchair.
I mean, it was a little intense. And then I just had a pretty severe whiplash. So going back to competing, when I would get done, I would get really severe tightness in my suboccipitals and up my neck. So I'd get done jumping and I remember trying to race and I couldn't, my eyes couldn't even focus down the line. I couldn't see because my suboccipitals would get so tight after, all that pounding from jumping. So I decided, as much as I enjoyed racing, as much as I enjoyed, the training is very similar. It just wasn't worth it. You have so many lessons in life all the time teach you about things and teach you about yourself. And I just realized if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do just the things that serve me and bring me joy.
So you're also doing some mentoring with girls who are having body image issues. How did that come about?
So that kind of organically built itself. I had been working at AMP camp for a couple of years. And a common theme that we kept having with my 15 to 16 to 17 year old girls was body issues. And at first it came from, limb loss, limb difference.
Sure.
But just growing up in this culture and the climate right now, it's a hot topic for everybody. And I started realizing that as far as amputees and as far as disability goes, our body quote problems are very simple because they're just out and open and you can't hide it, but there's a lot more beneath that surface, even below that. And I realized so much of our emotions, so much of our mental health is tied into what our bodies look like and how our bodies function, how they serve us. So that was another thing that kind of took shape on itself. And it's been fun trying to find ways not only to work with young girls now, but just working with all sorts of people, but with all sorts of different variables, and to show that our emotions and our just our well-being, everything is tied together.
I remember talking to Blake Lieber years ago, and you know, when we talked about him having alcohol and drug issues, and he said one of the hard parts for him was he knew every time he walked out the house that people would be staring at him.
Yeah.
And that was huge for him. But as a young person, before you're comfortable in your own skin and you've won Paralympic medals and all that type of stuff, you're a guy missing both legs. And every time you walk outside, people aren't, you know, it's like kids are great. They'll just come up to you and say, hey, what happened? Or why are you RoboCop? But, you know, for adults, we'll just sort of look at you or look at you sideways. How much was that something you had to deal with?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when I was younger, that took a toll on me. And it's weird because, like, no matter how big you get in your sport, no matter how celebrated of an athlete you are, like, we forget when the lights turn off and you go home, like, you're still who you are,
right?
You know, when your lights come off. And, like, it's an emotional burden to carry if you aren't prepared for it. And you can't control other people. But it is funny to see people do have emotional responses as far as bodies go. And it takes a lot of time, and honestly, I have an amazing psychologist. I have a sports psychologist named Mark Strickland, and he's helped me a ton. He's also just become my life psychologist.
Yeah.
But we, you know, there's so much that that your body does for you as an athlete that we forget that it's almost like borderline, like, psychotic abuse if we don't turn around and honor it and cherish it, like, no matter what it is. And I think with as far as, like, elite athletic performance with disability, we try so hard. We don't even acknowledge the disability. I mean, we do because it's a part of, the variable, but, you know, everything is so sport and performance focused, which is good, but there needs to be, like, almost a release, and you need to allow yourself to be okay with the body that you have when it's not performing
right.
The task that you need it to do.
Right.
Yeah.
So when did you connect with CAF?
I met Travis Ricks, actually, in 2010, I went to my first ever, I think, Amputee Coalition conference. I met him. He and I were actually at a Rio clinic together. We were testing on microprocessor knees with a company called Oser.
Yeah.
And he and I disconnected. We became friends. He was a cheerleader as well, so we became quick friends.
Wait a second. And, I didn't know that. Travis was
you
a cheerleader?
Didn't know
no,
Travis
I need photos.
Cheerleader.
I need photos of Travis as a cheerleader. Oh, my God.
Travis was a cheerleader. And,
wow.
We became quick friends, and he told me a little bit about CAF, and I didn't know what sport I wanted to do. In Colorado, I skied a couple seasons. I was a good ski racer, but I don't like getting cold.
I agree.
CAF has always been, it's just so cold. I love it, but man, it's cold. But CAF has always been a great resource for and super supportive for every athletic endeavor that I've ever done. And Travis was definitely like somebody that's spearheaded that and has helped me along my journey. Every single time that I've been reintroduced to somebody in the disability community, especially in a progressive sense of Trump's getting people to be active, to be athletic, and to go enjoy sport and find camaraderie in it, it's just been such an incredible journey. So CAF has definitely had a heavy influence on me throughout all of this.
Love it. Now, the running stuff is great, but the thing that really excites me is that you play the ukulele.
I love.
So I do a show, my show in Kona every year. It's called Breakfast with Bob, where I interview all the top athletes leading in to the race. And last year we did 75 interviews, and my ukulele player, Poncho Man, plays into and out of each interview. You have to check those out online.
I will have to definitely see that. You know, I have gotten really good over the years. As an athlete, you have a lot of free time, and I'm like, I should learn something fun and not related to sports at all. And that little instrument has just brought me so much joy and has just been so fun. It travels well, you know.
You know what? What's great about it, think about this. It's sort of like the Olympics. When we're over at Ironman, that is the Ironman World Championship for those people. It changes their life. You win that race, you finish top three, it's huge. So imagine somebody's, you know, sitting there for an interview with me, and these are going to be 10 to 15 minute interviews, and they're thinking, I need to get my bike ready. I got all sorts of things to do. And then all of a sudden, Poncho Man starts playing the ukulele, and you could see them just relax and a smile come over and go, what's 10 minutes? I can do 10 minutes. And it makes a huge difference. That whole idea of just somebody playing, and usually he'll create a tune specifically for each athlete. And
oh, that's cool.
It's very cool. He's very talented. But the fact that you're a ukulele player here in San Diego, we might have to do some stuff together.
I think so. I mean, that was definitely, I always think of, like, it's important to unplug from that matrix. We forget athletics is a matrix in and of itself. So that's been,
yes.
It's been fun.
Well, take a look at those. They're all up on YouTube, on my YouTube channel. But take a look at some of those and go, Bob, I think I could do that. I think we'd have some fun interviewing. We could go and do them at the Olympic Training Center down there in Chula Vista.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
And get some athletes, and we'll do some interviews, and you'll play ukulele leading into and out of each interview.
I love it.
That would be real. We could do it at San Diego Triathlon Challenge here in San Diego in October.
That'd
be really, really fun. Very cool. Now, how often are you here at the Olympic Training Center?
I just come for camps and like a lot of track meets. So later in the spring, I'll be here a lot. Typically, anywhere from like 1 to 2 times a month, I'll come down.
Good move.
For either a couple days or a couple weeks. You know, it's always so great to be here and see all the people, be at the training center. I've got great friends that live in town, and it's just, you know, San Diego's a happy place.
And San Diego is such a happy place. And it's usually, this weekend isn't a good example, but it's usually a warmer place.
I brought the Texas winter with me, so.
Now, are you in Texas? You grew up in Colorado, but you're living in Texas now?
I live in Texas now. Yep, I moved to Austin last year.
Oh, one of my favorite cities.
That's a great town. Honestly, Austin is a lot of fun.
Yeah, we had so much fun there. I used to do all the announcing for Lance Armstrong's events down there for the Ride for the Roses. And, yeah, we had some great, great times down there.
I think he's running the marathon right now, so you both have to check up on old Lance.
Oh, what? Which marathon is he running? Is he running something?
Boston Marathon.
Oh, is he going to run Boston this year? Oh, Austin. He's going to run.
Austin, yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, I know he was going to run in Arizona at Rock and Roll, but I think he had a little hamstring issue or something. So that's cool that he's running in his hometown. Very cool.
He'll be there.
Hey,
thank you so much.
Lacey, thank you for taking so much time. It was really an honor to get to chat with you. You're doing
Bob,
some great stuff.
Thank you. It's been, thank you for having me. It's been great connecting with you.
I love it. All right. And Lacey, if people want to check out what you're doing, if they want to help out with what you're doing for mentoring girls with body images, how can they find out more about you?
Yeah, I have a website, LaceyJHenderson.com. Lacey is spelled L-A-C-E-Y, like the adjective.
Yes,
I do a lot of Instagram stories, and that's another great resource to connect with me. Lacey is your friend. Twitter is Lacey is your friend. And that was it. That was an AOL screen name that has stuck with a lot of stuff. So
I love it.
You can find me.
Very cool. I like Lacey as my friend. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
All right. Lacey Henderson has been our guest. Again, we are brought to you by Tough Man Triathlon Series. Bye. VeloFix, the world's coolest mobile bike shop, by Polar. Blood, sweat, and data. CaliforniaTriathlon.org. 5 great 2019 race options, including Viking Dash Trail Run LA on April 7th. By our Challenged Athletes Foundation last year, 2,806 grants, totaling $4.3 million. Keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here.